Spullenberger determined he couldn't get back to the airport in time. Without a lot of options, and with absolutely no good options, he decided to land the plane on the Hudson River in New York City. Birds get sucked into plane turbines all the time, but it's exceedingly rare for the engine to be damaged. If it does happen, the pilot can just make a routine landing with one engine. For a double bird strike, to disable both engines goes to whatever category is well beyond exceedingly rare. Nobody could possibly plan or train for an incident as unexpected as losing two engines at 2,800 feet over the densely populated Manhattan Island. Sullenberger had to respond instantly. In the midst of the unforeseen, you do best if you can stay calm, call on your experience and knowledge, and look for a familiar pattern. As a retired U.S. Air pilot named John Wiley put it at the time, you take the picture you've got and you turn it into one that you recognize. You visualize the river like it's just another runway. Sullenberger landed Flight 1549 on the river, near the middle of Manhattan. The crew led the passengers off the plane and onto the floating wings to await the rescue boats that quickly arrived. A police helicopter with trained divers hovered above for anyone who jumped in panic into the icy water. All 155 people on board survived. Television reporters around the world called it the Miracle on the Hudson, and Sullenberger became an immediate hero. He got calls from two presidents and a standing ovation at the Super Bowl. A Clint Eastwood-directed movie about his heroics, called Sully, starring Tom Hanks as the calm and reticent pilot, got top reviews and earned more than $200 million at the box office. But it was the mayor of Sully's small hometown of Danville, California, who summed it up. "He had 2 minutes to make a decision. I can't even say my name that fast," said the mayor. Plane disasters always get attention because they are both unusual and terrifying. They make us feel out of control. But the triumph mixed with disaster in this case was even more compelling. It reminded us that any crisis may have a random cause. Birds, really? But the luck of survival depends on the same talent and hard work that defines luck in other circumstances. The right person can control the randomness of a crisis and produce a lucky result. Sullenberger had been flying for 40 years, but what ultimately mattered was what he did in the 208 seconds from bird strike to water landing. Sometimes you make luck over a lifetime. In a crisis, you make it in a few seconds. If you're not a pilot, but want to stay lucky when you're flying, the good news is that luck is already on your side. I came across a very amusing, in my view, app called Am I Going Down?, which lets you put in the flight details of your next trip and then uses official data from various transportation boards to tell you the likelihood of a crash. The app developer came up with the program to help his wife with her fear of flying. His idea was that if you're worried about flying, you don't need to take sleeping pills. You should just take the truth. So, for example, if you're flying on a British Airways 747 from London to New York, the app says you have a 1 in 9 million chance of going down. You could take the flight every day for the next 25,000 or so years without a problem. Still need that Xanax? When I chatted about this with Barnaby, he told me that he had once been on a small Cessna when the engine cut out at a few thousand feet. There was an ominous quiet in the cabin, and looking out the window, he could see the single propeller had stopped cold. His heart seemed to stop cold, too. Fortunately, the pilot was able to restart the engine. The good news is that most plane crashes aren't fatal. In one study of commercial crashes involving about 53,000 people, some 98% survived. Admittedly, a small Cessna may not do as well. If you are in a crash, is there a way to make luck? In 2013, scientists and test pilots purposely crashed a Boeing 727 filled with sensors and test dummies in the Mexican desert. They found that the back of the plane is the safest place to be. About 78% of the passengers in the back section would have survived, while those in the first dozen rows didn't do as well. Being in the middle of the plane, over the wings, was, well, in the middle. The researchers did offer the caveat that a different kind of crash, i.e. tail first, would have a different outcome. The overall chances of death on a commercial flight are 1 in 4.7 million. So Barnaby pointed out that any time he gets a nifty first-class upgrade, he intends to keep it. Going to the back of the plane doesn't do very much to improve those already excellent odds. You can make yourself luckier by wearing your seatbelt, and if there's an unexpected landing, bracing for impact, as passengers did on Sully's flight. If you're really serious about increasing luck on a plane, you might want to bring a face mask or a large bottle of Purell, since the biggest danger on a flight may be from the germs you pick up. With millions of people hopscotching daily all over the country and the world, we do better than ever at sharing ideas and innovations. But we have also created a giant mixing pot of viruses and bacteria. Most germs put you in bed for a day or two, but Barnaby reminded me that some, like Ebola virus or flesh-eating bacteria, are outright deadly. What concerns epidemiologists is that sooner or later there will be a pathogen that wipes out 500 million people or more before they can find a way to stop it. With that unsettling thought in mind, we gave a call to Pardis Sabeti, a brilliant scientist and mathematician whom Barnaby knew from their days at Oxford. She first gained academic fame when she was in her mid-20s for breakthroughs linking changes in DNA structures to better methods of fighting disease. She's now a full professor at Harvard and is known around Cambridge for rollerblading to classes and singing in an alternative rock band. When Ebola hit West Africa in 2014, Dr. Sabeti led a group that used genomic sequencing to figure out how the deadly disease was being transmitted and better ways to identify and treat it. The disease was terrifying. There was no vaccine or drug to fight it. People were dying quickly. Dr. Sabeti told us that she put three mottos on the board for her team during the outbreak, and they could be guidelines for anyone looking to stay lucky and healthy during a major outbreak. They were, 1, safety first. 2, no wishful thinking. 3, prioritize. The only way to avoid bad luck is to recognize that it can happen, Dr. Sabeti said. We've had plagues in the past, and you have to be very respectful of the power of darkness. Not underestimating the potential for bad things to happen is one of the best ways to avoid them. To Dr. Sabeti, safety first meant thinking about how to mitigate risk while moving forward. Prioritizing became crucial because you want to figure out what you can do that will add value rather than getting on your horse and riding off in all directions, she said. In the context of any crisis, wishful thinking may be the most dangerous problem of all. The guys who were partying as the hurricane came in and the people who stayed at the nightclub as the fire broke out were all victims of wishful thinking. Nothing bad can happen because it hasn't before. During the Ebola outbreak, Dr. Sabeti became frustrated with policymakers whose approach was, maybe it won't spread to Sierra Leone or maybe it won't come to America. Magical or wishful thinking isn't the way to make a decision, she said. One way to create good luck in a crisis is to avoid bad luck, and that requires clear-sighted planning. Some people think that if you get an insurance policy, you're willing something bad to happen, but it's quite the opposite, she said. You batten down the hatches so that you can relax. If you've thought about the worst-case scenario, you're prepared for everything. In the context of this outbreak, I would see people working from the premise that the virus wouldn't mutate. Much better to say, maybe it will mutate, and then what? Dr. Sabeti believes you make luck in a crisis by being neither complacent nor alarmist. She found herself telling people over and over, don't be scared, be prepared. At one point, early in the Ebola crisis, before any cases had come to America, she was giving a talk at a conference of Harvard's biggest donors. I told all these billionaires to go out and get a bunch of canned products that would allow them to stay inside for 21 days, she said. I didn't say it to make them panic and go crazy, but let's say in an ideal world you have 21 days of canned food at home. The outbreak gets resolved quickly, and you give the food to the homeless. Isn't that better than if you wait, 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 thinking everything will be okay, and then it's not okay? Then you have scenes like in the movies where people are punching each other in grocery stores. During an outbreak, Dr. Sabetti thinks that more information brings more luck. It's true on a global scale, where shared findings usually lead to better public health outcomes. And it's also true for an individual. If you understand what's going on, you can take reasonable steps and avoid mass hysteria. She's currently trying to create a global outbreak surveillance system, starting with an app that Harvard students can use when they have an infection. They input their symptoms and get information about what might be wrong. An individual diagnosis is hard to make in infectious disease. 99% of the time, you have no idea what it is, but just hope it's not lethal, she said. But when it's a shared event with multiple samplings, the signal-to-noise ratio improves. There's more chance of recognizing the start of an outbreak. You want a system that's comfortable for people so that they can immediately leverage it in a crisis scenario, she said. It's like the kidnap training I got when I was traveling. You got kidnap training? I asked, interrupting her in surprise. Yes, several times. In the middle of a crisis, your field of vision narrows and you lose your logical stance. Everything goes very dark. You want to have everything at your fingertips before you even start. The key to luck and survival is understanding what you can control and what you can't, and so avoiding the panic. However good you are at grabbing the opportunities to make a lucky life, some things can happen to throw you off. Illness, death, and political upheaval, or kidnapping, can upend the best laid plans. Things change, often unexpectedly. As the author Joan Didion wrote shortly after her husband collapsed in their living room from a massive heart attack, life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner and life as you know it ends. Didion was struck by the ordinariness of tragedy. Confronted with sudden disaster, we all focus on how unremarkable the circumstances were in which the unthinkable occurred, she said. Tragedy can come from the clear blue sky, often literally. The morning of September 11th, 2001 was clear and cloudless, and people often describe the sunshine of that morning with a kind of awe, as if there should have been some greater warning, some black clouds and thunderstorms, before the planes struck the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. For Dr. Sabetti, personal disaster also came on the day of a cloudless sky. Soon after the Ebola crisis, she was invited to give the opening talk at a conference of world leaders. The kind of event where politicians and celebrities and Silicon Valley stars and global leaders all gather. You can imagine Ashton Kutcher and the president of Mexico jamming with Senator Cory Booker and a high-tech CEO. In the mornings, they hear smart talks and in the afternoons engage with one another in sports activities that Dr. Sabetti described as insane and way too risky. Being a keynote speaker at this kind of gathering is a big deal. And Dr. Sabetti prepared for the day with an hour and a half of stretching and handstands and other crazy stuff. Her talk was extremely well received, and everyone was busy discussing it afterward and gathering around her. People started weighing in on what I should do for the afternoon, she said. Her original plan for rope climbing got shunted aside when she discovered a participant the previous year had shattered an ankle. So she switched to an ATV tour when she was told it was the safest option. Somehow, in this context, I just took it on face value and didn't ask a lot of very specific questions about safety, she said. Little did I know that even though we were on a road, it was on the side of a 200-foot drop. Basically, the driver lost control and jumped out, and we went over a cliff. Thrown from the ATV, she was smashed against boulders that crushed her pelvis and knees and caused head injuries. Dr. Sabetti was flown from Montana to a trauma center in Seattle, where she went through 25 hours of surgery in 4 days. Doctors said I had a 5-8% chance of survival, she said. Most people with this kind of multiple trauma die. I'm one of the luckiest of the unluckiest. Given her experience in dealing with crises and disaster, Dr. Sabetti has played and replayed her own accident in her mind. Even in an unforeseeable situation, she thinks preparation helps. She was in such good shape that her tissue regenerated quickly, and her body was resilient enough to survive daily blood transfusions. I have 40 plates in my body, and I suffered a serious concussion where I couldn't read for 4 months. My vision changed, and I have chronic vertigo. Most people in my condition never go back to work, she said. But she is back in her lab, and though it took many months, she is again bubbling with ideas that she cares about. After any disaster, an earthquake or a hurricane, a plane crash or an Ebola outbreak or a devastating accident, the survivors don't just pick up their lives where they left off. They are forever changed. They are stunned by the random chance that left them living and also slightly overwhelmed to realize that their own actions contributed to their fate. In the unluckiest of circumstances, they found a way to emerge as one of the lucky survivors. It is scary and sobering. Dr. Sabetti's physical struggles may never go away, but she will continue making luck for herself and others. Nobody wants to be in an earthquake or hurricane, and not a lot of good comes from hotel fires or airplane crashes or devastating accidents. Being one of the lucky survivors can feel very random. But a willingness to prepare, think calmly, and involve your higher brain can give you the very narrow, lucky edge that just might make the difference. Part 5, The Big Picture. Anything's possible in human nature. Love, madness, hope, infinite joy. Arundhati Roy, The God of Small Things. Chapter 16, The Lucky Path, Find Your Compass. Know that you have many possibilities. Navigate with a compass, not a map. Change the song with the next note you play. Barnaby came back from his luck lab one day, excited about how far we'd come. He was confident that we had uncovered the ways to create lucky opportunities on many fronts. But for the next step, he was thinking about what luck meant in a larger context. The big question we have left is what makes a lucky life, he said. We've figured out all the ingredients that go into it, but now you have to put them together in the right way. The ingredients we had lined up included generating more luck for yourself in all sorts of ways. Success in your career, confidence with your kids, energy in your love life, and an ability to turn bad days into good ones. All that gives you a sense of control over the possibilities ahead. But as you put all those lucky pieces together, what do they add up to in the bigger sense? It's a little bit like baking, Barnaby said. You have the salt and the flour and the water, but how you blend them together makes all the difference. You can end up with a loaf of white bread or a fancy challah. You have to know which you prefer and what you're trying to make. Barnaby didn't strike me as either a white bread or a challah guy, more like whole wheat with raisins and poppy seeds, or something equally unusual and interesting. But the point was fair enough. In luck and life, if you don't know where you're going, you're probably not going to get there. A few years earlier, Barnaby was investigating the expansive topic of meaning and purpose in life, and he did a study of students on college campuses. He wanted to find out how college would help them reach their larger life goals. But he quickly realized that most of the students didn't have larger life goals. They lacked a bigger picture of what would matter to them in life, Barnaby said. Students he met on campuses across the country spoke vaguely about their post-graduation future, but when he asked for specifics about the jobs they imagined, he got a lot of uncomfortable pauses and answers along the lines of, anything I can get, or something that pays a lot. The lack of clarity wasn't just about their career. Barnaby said he would have been happy if someone said he wanted to get married and have a house by the sea, or hoped to return to his hometown and help his ailing parents. Anything that suggested a deeper reflection on life and ultimate goals. It's hard enough turning an aspiration to reality when you have an aspiration, Barnaby said. To make luck, you have to think ahead and have a sense of what matters to you. Otherwise, you just wind up wherever the river takes you. I think that's called going with the flow, I said with a laugh. But you need to put yourself in the right place before luck can find you, Barnaby said earnestly. What you aim for has a big bearing on where you end up. Most of us understand that we can't control everything. When we asked people in our survey about elements in their own life that had led to luck, planning my life and career carefully landed in dead last place. Well over half the people in our survey thought their luck increased if they tried a new direction when a previous one wasn't working. The largest percentage, 64%, thought they got lucky by being curious and seeking new opportunities. But Barnaby was pointing out an important subtlety. Our respondents were completely right that you can't plan everything and have to be open to new opportunities. The ability to recognize those possibilities, often when others don't, lets you make luck. And that's the tricky part. You need a context in order to see what's around you. To go back to Barnaby's baking metaphor, you probably have flour and water and salt in your kitchen. But without some goal that involves making or eating or selling bread, those ingredients will just sit there. Once you take out the KitchenAid and start making that bread, your view of everything else changes. You see the possibilities that can make the lucky magic happen. The packages of dried fruit and raisins and chocolate bits that have been tucked away unnoticed in your cabinet for months suddenly take on new potential. You open them up, mix them in, and create a wonderful new loaf. When you win the blue ribbon at the county fair, you can modestly attribute it to the random chance of what happened to be in your cabinet. But it's more accurate to think of it as planned serendipity. You hadn't decided ahead on that particular result, but once you got on the right bread-making path, you were alert to opportunities and saw what others couldn't. What's true for baking bread is also true for building an airline. Barnaby had recently met Tony Fernandez, the entrepreneur who founded the no-frills airline Air Asia. As they spoke, Fernandez modestly attributed his success to serendipity. He told Barnaby that he had been thinking about how to create a low-cost way to fly for the more than half of Asians who never got on a plane. He was looking for the right entry point. After the tragedy of September 11, 2001, the costs for leasing planes dropped dramatically, so it was much easier to get into the business. As he said, serendipity. Or maybe not. I don't know what you were doing in late 2001, but I was here, and it didn't occur to me to buy an airline, I said when Barnaby told me the story. Yes, it's nice that he attributes his success to serendipity, Barnaby said. But he had been setting up his plan and was waiting for the right moment. When it occurred, he saw the opportunity and captured the luck. It has made him a billionaire. When I was very young, I saw life as a series of tests to pass, and I unconsciously figured that I just had to keep working hard and getting A's to end up with a lucky life. But at some point in my mid-20s, I realized that life wasn't the same as school at all. Instead of a steady path of courses and exams leading to the triumph of a cap and gown, I now had endless opportunities for jobs and love affairs and adventures that could lead anywhere. Looking back at my own experience, I can understand why the college students Barnaby interviewed seemed so vague. The path of success for middle-class kids is laid out very clearly. Do well in school, score high on your SATs, get into college. But then you graduate. And part of growing up is making the discovery that you need to pick your own path and make your own luck. Barnaby pointed out that our sense of what matters and what makes a lucky life changes over the years. When you were in high school, winning a track meet probably seemed like the most important thing in the world. But now the first place trophy is probably tucked away in the back of a closet. A few years later, you might have spent months obsessing about having the perfect wedding. But now that you're raising four kids and two dogs, you can't remember why that one day seemed to matter so much. The trophy and the wedding may both be part of a lucky life, but a single event of any sort brings luck only when it fits into a broader picture. So, for example, getting the starring role in a movie when you're just a kid could seem like the luckiest thing in the world. Lindsay Lohan surely felt that way when she starred in her first Disney movie at age 12 and had a quick streak of hits that made her a teen sensation before she was old enough to drive. How lucky is that? The years of drug abuse and rehab that followed would suggest it wasn't very lucky for her at all. But Lohan is barely in her early 30s now, so she may turn those bad years around and move forward. Drew Barrymore did it after similar early circumstances. Lohan was on the lucky path and fell off. She can get back on it, or choose a different path, or figure out what, in a greater sense, would make a lucky life for her. The even younger actress Emma Watson got her first professional acting role playing Hermione Granger in the blockbuster Harry Potter movies. Uh-oh. After Lohan, we all knew what happened to young stars. But Emma stayed sane. She took time to make other movies, graduate from Brown University, and become an international advocate for women's rights. Oh, and she got certified as a yoga teacher and meditates so that she can always be at home with myself. Starring in Freaky Friday or Harry Potter is just an event. Whether you turn it into a lucky life or a disaster depends on what you do with it, the path you follow, the next step you take. It made me think of the great jazz musician Miles Davis, who used to say that there's no such thing as a wrong note in jazz. It's the next note you play that makes it right or wrong. He could have said there's no such thing as a right note either. You can start with something wonderful and turn it sour, or start with the flattest sound and make it sing. Being able to play a riff on any note, that's called jazz. It's also called what makes you lucky in life. Part of the thrill of a jazz club is hearing one musician play off the next, picking up on what the other person has done and making it different and bigger and maybe greater. What ultimately matters is how it all fits together. Those paths to luck are sometimes checkered, and we seem to unconsciously believe that life should even out. When something good happens to a person who has been struggling, we sigh in relief and say, "You deserved it." And when we hear about a celebrity facing troubles, we sympathize but aren't completely surprised. It just makes them more human. Nobody can have everything. I was thinking about lucky paths and how you get on and off them when I got a call from Prince Talal of Jordan, who was visiting New York and suggested we get together. Because we are involved in the same international organization, we have gotten to know each other over the years. I always liked talking to him because he is deeply intellectual and grasps the subtleties of life. So meeting him for coffee at the St. Regis Hotel sounded like a good idea. Prince Talal is the grandson of one king and the nephew of another, and as we sat down, it occurred to me that it hadn't been very difficult for him to get on a lucky path. A prince, by definition, is born lucky. Maybe luck doesn't fall from the sky, but it certainly gets sprinkled down from the gene pool. Even though he was dressed casually, slim jeans and a James Purse t-shirt, if you must know, there was a regal air about him that he seems never to lose. He graciously asked about my work, and so we started talking about luck. He made a few thoughtful comments about the need to make choices and create your own destiny. I fiddled with my coffee cup and finally asked if a prince, a guy who has been called Your Royal Highness his whole life, could understand the concept of making your own luck. "Of course I can," he said, furrowing his thick eyebrows. "Some people would say that you didn't have to make your luck. It was handed to you," I said carefully. His searing eyes made it clear that he wasn't falling for the journalistic fallback of "some people would say." "Is that what you think?" he asked. I cleared my throat. I sipped some water. "You tell me," I said. And so he did. Luck was handed to him? Maybe not entirely. When Prince Talal was 16, he went water skiing one day in the Gulf of Aqaba in the Red Sea. The driver of the boat got too close to a jetty, and Talal smashed into it with full force. With massive internal injuries, he spent 8 months at the Methodist Hospital in Houston, where he wavered on the brink of death and lost half his liver and a portion of his lung. "8 months in the hospital?" I asked. "When you're in that situation, you have no bigger view," he said. "You just get through each day." Royal blood or not, he couldn't expect anyone else to save him. For 8 months, he pushed through. He survived. He left the hospital, graduated from the Royal Military Academy in the UK, and returned to being fearless. 10 years after the jetty accident, and just 6 months after his marriage to the beautiful Princess Gita, he had a second big blow when he was diagnosed with cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It's possible that the medications he took after the first injury led to the cancer, or at least complicated the problem. So began another round of hospitalizations and extensive treatments. At that age, all you want to do is live, and you put all your energy into it, he said. As he talked, I realized why making luck had become such a compelling topic to me. Because everyone, whoever you are and wherever you start, has to play by its rules. Random events happen, and you have the choice of how to handle them. The hard work and resilience and determination and persistence that you put in at that point give you the lucky life or not. Prince Talal was not giving in or giving up. He pushed through for a second time and kept pushing to remake his life and body. He got back on the path he had earlier chosen, continued his military career, and climbed to the top ranks. He has the straightest posture you've ever seen. I felt like I was slouching even when I wasn't, and a never-quit defiance in his bearing. I heard that you run marathons now, I said. His eyebrows unfurrowed and he gave a little smile. I don't always like it, but the best choice is to keep going, he said in his elegant British accent. Today, Prince Talal is strong and fit, with muscles layered on his slim frame. Yes, I noticed. You get that by hard work, not luck. I take my duty and responsibility seriously, he told me. When I first met Prince Talal at an event some years earlier, I saw him as privileged and fortunate and existing in a lucky circle of elites that I could only begin to imagine. He was elegantly bedecked in gold cufflinks and a pocket square and an English tailored suit so perfectly cut it could draw blood. I didn't know about his accident or cancer or the real tenacity it takes to keep going when your life has been turned upside down. It had taken me until now to understand that whether you're a prince or a king, you're not guaranteed a life of happiness. Like everyone else, you make your luck happen. Prince Talal got himself on the lucky path by knowing that whatever gifts he had been born with could easily be taken away. When you fight to make a lucky future for yourself and your family, you have the best chance of getting one. When I next saw Barnaby, I told him about the conversation. It struck me that when you're looking from the outside, it's very easy to misjudge the source of luck. Was I right about the prince's fortitude in creating his luck, well beyond family and title, or had I just fallen for his royal charm? No, you're right, Barnaby said, nodding thoughtfully. You don't get lucky by a single event, even if it's the conditions of your birth. Coming from royalty is like starring young in a popular movie. You can end up being a Lindsay Lohan or an Emma Watson. In creating a lucky life, everything is contingent on so many other things that are happening. Wherever you start, you end up with a big chain of causal structures that can each lead to luck, Barnaby said. Dealing with circumstances as they come up, putting each link into place, is one way to increase your luck. But trying to predict what will happen doesn't necessarily increase your luck at all. Each day, millions or billions of possibilities are swirling around you, and the slightest change in one or another can lead to a new and unexpected outcome. Scientists call this chaos theory. It was first described by the mathematician and meteorologist Edward Norton Lorenz after he used a computer model to make a weather prediction, and the prediction turned out completely wrong. Lorenz ultimately concluded that a tiny, really, really tiny deviation in the first number he input to the model changed everything afterward. This might have been the most elaborate explanation ever created for getting a weather forecast wrong. Lorenz went on to show that a small variance in an initial condition keeps multiplying and changes everything that happens afterward. He offered the now much-cited image of a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil, setting off a tornado in Texas. The butterfly stirs enough molecules to change the atmosphere just a little bit. The change gets bigger and bigger and moves across the world. And before you know it, the unstable air leads to that tornado ripping through a fancy neighborhood in Texas. Maybe it upends the house of a former president who has to be rescued from the ruins. Why did this happen? What did I do wrong? He asks. What he did wrong in life might be a long list or a short one, but it has nothing at all to do with the tornado or the wreckage or the fact that the former president is now homeless. Sound fanciful? As often happens, a science fiction writer got there before the scientists. In his short story, A Sound of Thunder, author Ray Bradbury envisioned a group of hunters traveling back to the time of the dinosaurs. All has been arranged so that they don't disrupt history. For example, they can shoot a dinosaur only when it is about to die anyway. But after their journey, they return to their own time again and discover the present has indeed changed. The recent election had ended with a different winner. One of the hunters notices a crushed butterfly on his boot and realizes that the death of the butterfly all that time ago initiated enough changes that an election turned out differently. I tentatively asked Barnaby if he thought that chaos theory put our theory of making luck into question. If a butterfly flapping its wings or crushed beneath a boot can influence tornadoes and elections, how can we expect to be in control of our own lives and luck? Barnaby sat forward eagerly. Whenever you hear people talk about the butterfly effect, you have to remember that there are thousands or millions of other things also going on, he said. There are so many butterflies flapping their wings. Each one may have a downstream effect, but you have lots of chances along the way to affect things and make changes. I smiled. Of course. Even if that butterfly is in some way causing the storm, you have the chance to build a tornado-proof house. Or you can choose to live in an area where bad weather doesn't happen. The worst thing is to feel that you can't control anything and being afraid to try. Then you're left at the mercy of butterflies, or other people, Barnaby said. You don't want to be the fool waiting for things to happen and saying that whatever is good and whatever is bad and there's nothing you can do. The butterfly creates the tornado only if nobody does anything along the way. I love that attitude, I admitted with a big grin. Passionate about the topic, Barnaby started talking a little faster. We all have so many chances to change things. The cards you're dealt aren't the ones you have to play with all along. You get to swap them out and decide which ones to hold on to and which to throw away, he said. He had been reading that morning about the three fates of antiquity, the goddesses in Greek and Roman mythology who were often depicted in art as spinning the threads of life. They decided when life started and ended, but they didn't control everything that happened along the way. Many religions that followed have a similar concept that some things are determined, but much remains in our control. Fate is what will happen if you don't do anything, but destiny is your potential and requires your action along the way, Barnaby said. It reminded me of the old joke about the man who prayed every day to win the lottery. The drawing came and went, and he didn't win. So he prayed some more. Another lottery, and another, and he still didn't win. God, I'm a good man. I'm devout and ethical. Why can't you let me win the lottery? What more do you want from me? He asked in frustration. Maybe you can help me out and at least buy a ticket, God replied. Barnaby laughed. Benjamin Franklin would like that. I think he had the line that God helps those who help themselves. I checked, and Sophocles first said something like that back in about 400 BC, and Euripides and Ovid had versions of it too. 17th century French and English philosophers made it popular. Help thyself and God will help thee, said priest and poet George Herbert. And then Franklin brought it to America. In other words, the idea that luck comes to those who make it for themselves has deep roots in both poetry and religion. Barnaby pointed out that whatever your religious beliefs, whether you believe in destiny or fates or free will, the greatest regret most people have comes from looking back and feeling that they didn't quite do enough to reach their potential. Lucky people are those who are willing to put themselves on the line, be a little fearless, and give their all to achieve a goal. It's better to have tried and failed than never to have tried at all. If you ran in the Olympics and didn't win the gold medal, at least you ran in the Olympics, Barnaby said. The bigger regret and unhappiness comes if you didn't try out, and you always wonder what might have been. Avoiding those regrets means having an aim and knowing what will ultimately make you feel lucky. That doesn't mean you have to get on a single path and stay there, but you do have to know where you're headed. I mentioned to Barnaby that I had just come across a comment from Joey Ito, the entrepreneur and head of the MIT Media Lab, suggesting that it was better to navigate through life with a compass rather than a map. I liked the image, and it struck me as exactly the way to get lucky. With a compass, you need to know the general direction you want to go, and then stay alert as you follow the twists and turns of your own path. A map, or Google Maps, gives you a rigid route to follow, and as you trudge along, you may miss the turns that lead to luck. "Sure, I've worked with Joey," Barnaby said. Of course he had. He's a genius and often talks about the incredible speed of change in the technology world. What's interesting is that as things move faster and faster, that compass image becomes even more relevant. To make luck in a quickly changing world, you need a general idea where you're headed, but you also need to be able to stay flexible and make turns. Going in the right direction doesn't necessarily mean following the dotted line on your GPS. If everyone else is going on that path, you might want to choose a different one. Navigating with a compass requires you to be a bit more fearless, but it brings those lucky opportunities that Joey Ito surmised. My very athletic husband and I often take long hikes in the woods, and he is definitely a compass kind of guy. He knows where he's headed, but he wants to make his own route to get there. One day recently, we were hiking on a pretty trail, and since I was worried about protruding roots, loose stones, and darting snakes, I kept my head down and stared at my feet for every step. I didn't really know where we were headed. I just followed behind him, thinking only about the next step. "Did you see that magnificent hawk?" Ron asked, turning back to me as we neared the top of the steep climb. "Nope," I said. "It was circling right above us as we passed through that big band of white pines," he said. "White pines?" I asked. "Yes, right after the waterfall." "What waterfall?" While I looked only at the tops of my boots, Ron had perfected the skill of watching the path while looking forward and upward and all around, which is where lucky sightings are made. He'd had experiences that I had missed, because if you keep your head down as you walk through life, either literally or metaphorically, you miss the opportunity to make yourself lucky. If you have an idea where you're headed and the confidence that one way or another you'll get there, then you can reach the top of the mountain and still pause to see the magnificent hawk. Getting on one path and then switching to another when the time is right may be the best formula for creating luck over the whole arc of your life. But most of us are slightly myopic about the future. We have situations to deal with every day, problems that need solving, jobs that are demanding, and children who need snacks or homework help or midnight comforting. We feel lucky enough if we handle those immediate concerns. Like the college students Barnaby met, focused on their immediate concerns like classes, beer, and football games, we know the future will come, but we figure it will take care of itself. It's like the exchange in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland between Alice and the Cheshire Cat, Barnaby said. Alice wants to go to amazing places, but she doesn't know exactly where. So the cat replies that she will ultimately get somewhere if she simply walks long enough. It's a funny line, but it's also what most of us do. Just keep walking and figure life will happen, good or bad. People intent on making luck ignore the Cheshire Cat's advice and know ahead of time the amazing place they want to end up. As Barnaby put it, they make plans and stick to them. And if the plan fails, they try something else and something else, until they succeed in weaving past life's inevitable setbacks. Barnaby had just come back from a conference in California where he met several impressive people who had made luck over the whole arc of their lives by knowing when it was time to go in a new direction. One of them was Sherry Lansing, the former president of production at 20th Century Fox and CEO of Paramount Pictures. "How cool that you met her. She was always one of my role models," I said. Lansing had made luck for herself at a time when it wasn't easy for women to do that. She was the first woman to head a Hollywood studio and had a long string of successes, including movies like Fatal Attraction and Titanic. She was an inspiration to all of us who followed her, and she was known for being creative and kind and beautiful. She's still all that, including beautiful, Barnaby said. In fact, she's radiant. She walks into a room and you can feel the glow. I hope you told her that, I said. When she was 60, Lansing had done the unexpected and walked away from her glamorous Hollywood life. People were shocked. Nobody gives up the bright lights and power unless they have to. But Lansing was determined to move on. Even if you love what you do, you need to know when it's time to let go and take a new path, she told Barnaby. Then offering a bit of advice, she added, change keeps you young, so never stop changing. Figuring that you don't make a lucky life by repeating yourself, she got involved in projects to fight cancer and revamp public education. Now, 10 years later, the joy she once found in making movies is directed in new ways. And apparently it is making her happy and radiant. At that same conference, Barnaby spent some time talking with his friend Arianna Huffington, who started her eponymous Huffington Post from nothing and eventually sold it to AOL for $315 million. Like Lansing, she implicitly understood that part of the lucky life equation involves switching paths at the right moment. The very determined Huffington had been on many paths in her life. Author, activist, wife of a congressman, candidate for governor of California, conservative and liberal. But the Huffington Post gave her global recognition. She told Barnaby that she got used to working 18-hour days, one sure way to make luck. But then one April afternoon, she collapsed at her desk from exhaustion, and as she fell down, her head clipped the corner of her desk, breaking her cheekbone. Her next memory was of being on the floor in a pool of blood and thinking, is this what success looks like? Like Lansing, Huffington decided that it was time to focus on something that would give a different meaning to her life. I used to walk down the street, either talking on my phone or looking at messages. Then one day I looked around near where I live in Soho and saw a most beautiful building. I asked my friend when it went up, and she said, in 1929. I wondered what else I had been missing. It occurred to Huffington that if we're not paying attention, we sometimes miss the little things, like beautiful architecture, that make us feel lucky. And maybe we also miss the big things, like building blocks for a healthy life. I had become so used to being exhausted that it took that episode of falling on the floor for me to look at my life and reevaluate, she said, rounding out her financial success with a kind of spiritual and emotional good luck. She left the Huffington Post to get on a new path of spreading health and wellness and balance through a company she named Thrive Global. She has even been on a campaign to encourage people to get more sleep. Maybe luck comes with our good dreams. The idea of making luck by switching paths suddenly seemed to be in the air. Victor Nee, the Cornell professor we had taken a walk with through Central Park a few months earlier, got back in touch with Barnaby to tell him about the progress he was making in his study of tech firms. He had found that one indicator of success was how quickly a company could rewire. In tech, the ground is constantly shifting, and what was hot 6 months ago is old news today, he said. The critical skill becomes the ability to reinterpret the core strengths of a new market. A key was an update on what he had previously described to us as knowledge spillover. Whatever new path you took, you could use the knowledge you had gained in one situation to create success and luck in another unrelated situation. You don't have to be a tech genius or a media mogul to see the value of rewiring. Barnaby pointed out that most of us do it naturally throughout our lives. You go from being a successful college student to having a career or being a parent, he said. There are different junctures where you take different turns to make a new form of luck. Remember the inverted V's that Barnaby drew once to show me the hills and valleys we all face in our lives? Now he reminded me that part of climbing up and making luck in one area of life is climbing down again. You can try jumping from peak to peak, But a lucky life also includes those times in between the highs. Making a lucky life means appreciating where you are now, but still looking ahead for new opportunities. As life changes, you need the courage to look for new challenges and find luck in new places. That seemed like a good start for making a lucky life. But as it turns out, there's one more thing you need, and we were about to discover it. Chapter 17, The Lucky Attitude. Believe that you can make luck. Believe you are lucky. Treat triumph and disaster the same. Look for the joy. Walking down the street one day, I realized that after all the time Barnaby and I had spent investigating luck, I was feeling luckier. I had been encouraging myself to recognize opportunities, make thoughtful moves, and persist when others quit. I was exhilarated by the idea that you have more control over all aspects of your life than you sometimes realize. No matter who you are, luck isn't a given. You have to make it happen for yourself. But I was still intrigued by Barnaby's question of what, in the grander view, made a lucky life. So the next time we met, I decided to turn the question on him. "What is a lucky life?" I asked. "Realizing your dreams and potentials, I suppose," Barnaby said. Then he looked at me and laughed. "Quick answer, but unsatisfying, right?" "Right," I agreed. "Try it this way. Who's your role model for a lucky life? Somebody you would trade places with right now." He looked off into the distance for a couple of minutes, and I could practically see his brain ticking through various possibilities. I sipped iced tea. I waited. Finally, I mentioned a couple of extremely wealthy people whom he had been hanging out with recently, flying on their planes, visiting their private islands, having meetings in their enormous townhouses. Barnaby knows a lot of billionaires since he has advised many of them on how to make the greatest impact with their philanthropy. If you're looking for people who've had a lucky life, they seemed a reasonable place to begin. "I like them and admire what they can do in the world with their resources," Barnaby said. "But as individuals, they struggle just like the rest of us." He mentioned that one had gone through a couple of divorces and another was having difficulties with a grown child. "They've been very successful in some ways," he said, "but have they made a luckier life overall? I don't really know." "And you're not willing to trade in your wife and daughters to find out," I said. "Definitely not," he said with a laugh. "I'm already lucky there." The last question in our national survey asked, "Do you think of yourself as a lucky person?" Some 67% of people said yes, and 33% said no. Barnaby and I wondered if specific factors made some people feel luckier than others. So he analyzed the data, looking for demographic differences. And he couldn't find any. No matter where you lived, how much money you made, whether you were male or female, married or not, your chances of calling yourself a lucky person were about the same. So if outside events didn't influence your perception of being lucky, could it be that what made you lucky was simply thinking you are lucky? Your own attitude and optimism and sense of hope could ultimately define whether you had a lucky life. I was pondering the idea the next evening as I sipped rosé at a wine tasting organized by a friend of my husband, a gregariously charming doctor named Michael Nakomovitz. The room was packed with interesting people, and toward the end of the evening, I met a scientist named Jonathan Stamler, who had flown in from Cleveland for the occasion. When I told him I was investigating luck, he immediately responded. "I do lab research, so I know all about luck," he said. Stamler was funny and smart and, I later discovered, world-renowned for a discovery he had made related to protein function in cells. He immediately told me about a friend and colleague of his who had recently won the Nobel Prize and thought that luck played a real role in science. Not the random chance kind of luck, a very different shade. "He's brilliant, and a lot of great researchers want to work in his lab," Stamler told me excitedly. "When he interviews them, he'll talk to them a long time, and then the last question he asks is, 'Are you lucky?' If someone says no, they don't get hired, no matter how good they are." "Is that the Napoleon theory?" I asked. noting that as the great emperor waged wars, he supposedly said, "I'd rather have generals who are lucky than good." Stamler smiled. "It's subtler than that. In research, it's important to believe that you're lucky. Any discovery requires creativity and openness and a willingness to try the unexpected. You need a positive attitude and a belief that you can find something innovative. If you don't think you're lucky, you won't be lucky." Now I smiled too. If some of the top scientists in the country recognized that the right outlook was necessary to be lucky in the lab, then we were on to something important. Looking around the room, I realized that a positive attitude could make luck for just about anyone. As if to prove it, a pretty young woman named Victoria James came over to refill our wine glasses. With her youthful face and gentle style, she might have been easy to overlook. "A lot of people still mistake me for the coat check girl," she said with a sweet smile. But she was actually a big star in the food world, the youngest woman ever to become a certified sommelier. She had written a book about rosé wine and had a big reputation in some of the city's best restaurants. Now barely in her mid-20s, she spent her time traveling around the world tasting wine, and she oversaw the buying and selling of expensive bottles for the Michelin-starred restaurant where we were gathered. "Do you believe you're lucky?" I asked as she joined our conversation. "You have to believe that in this business," she said. She laughingly admitted that she once tried growing Pinot Noir grapes in a pot on her fire escape. The venture didn't quite work out, but when you believe in yourself, the circles of a lucky life spiral in many directions. She now has a boyfriend who makes an award-winning California rosé from grapes grown on real soil. Becoming a wine expert may sound like a la-di-da ambition, not the path to a lucky life for the rest of us down-to-earth types, but Victoria seemed sensible and pragmatic and far from haute monde. "I got my first job as a waitress when I was 13, she said. She found the one diner near her home that would look the other way at underage labor. The kind of place where a lot of the waitresses were named Flo, she said. A few years later, when she needed money for college, she realized that bartenders earned more than waitresses. "But I knew nothing about wine or liquor, so I decided to learn," she said. She took classes, made friends in the field, studied and tasted endlessly. Newly passionate about wine and knowing it was a field dominated by arrogant older men, she made flashcards with 20,000 entries before taking her sommelier exam. She believed in her own lucky future, and so she made one happen. It never bothered her that she might not be welcome in the fancy inner circles of wine connoisseurs. She was determined. She had a positive attitude. She made her luck. When she walked away again, I marveled to Dr. Stamler about how far talent could take you when coupled with determination and the belief that you could become lucky. "Do you think you'll win a Nobel Prize like your friend did?" I asked. He looked startled at the question. I was just being provocative, but I later discovered through confidential sources that his name was regularly in the running. "There's a lot that goes into winning," he said. "An important breakthrough worthy of international acclaim was just the start. You also had to play the proper academic politics, get people on your side, and believe in yourself enough to get other people to believe too. The early morning call that came from the Swedish Academy was always depicted as a complete surprise, but it rarely came from out of the blue. Most of the recipients had worked very hard to make the good luck come their way." Sipping my rosé, I realized that whether you want to be a scientist or sommelier or win the Nobel Prize, the answer to, "Are you a lucky person?" should always be yes. Because the very first step to a lucky life is a positive attitude. It's not mystical or preordained. It's just that the more you believe you can make your own luck, the more you will do exactly that. You make a lucky life by believing that you deserve to be lucky. A few days later, Barnaby and I continued to talk about what makes a lucky life, and he told me about Dr. George Valiant, a psychiatrist and professor he knew who spent decades contemplating the ingredients for a good life. It wasn't theoretical. Valiant oversaw the famous Harvard study that tracked hundreds of men, yes, they were all men in those days, from the time they were college sophomores in 1938 until the end of their lives. One of the longest-running studies ever done, it looked at what made people happy and healthy. Essentially, they were trying to uncover the ingredients for a lucky life, Barnaby said. George always told me that the answer was very clear. When people looked back, it wasn't fame or wealth or high achievement that made them happy. It was the quality of their relationships. The study had gone for